SBS, a world of difference. You're with NITV Radio, on mobile, online and on radio.
We acknowledge the traditional owners of the land NITV Radio broadcasts from, the Wurundjeri Woiwurrung people of the Kulin Nation and their elders past and present. We also acknowledge all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander tribes and clans we broadcast to, from the mountains to the plains, from the desert to the sea, from fresh water to salt water.
Yama, and welcome to NITV Radio. Bertrand Tungandamengea. Today is Monday, October 14, 1 year after the failed referendum on Indigenous voice to Parliament. Referendum whose result shocked the nation with severe emotional impact on communities. Hence our program today will reflect on the referendum 1 year on, featuring exclusive stories brought to us by SBS Examine's Deputy Editor Rachel Knowles. We have an interview with UNSW's Professor Gabrielle Appleby reflecting on her involvement in the process leading up to the referendum, from her participation in different regional dialogues and her involvement in combating disinformation and misinformation in media. We also have a yarn with Tagalaka and Gumajman Konaboden, a teacher who, instead of being able to teach and pass on knowledge, found himself fighting a stream of misinformation through social media. We also feature Aboriginal Torres Strait Islander Social Justice Commissioner Cathy Case reflecting on where she was when the vote was called. She also reflects on the result and the severe emotional impact on communities who had to grapple with feelings of rejection. All these stories after the latest news.
Australia Day 1972 saw the first Aboriginal embassy erected outside Parliament.
The native title legislation must be amended.
And they've walked this land so many times before anybody came.
I am sorry.
In this bulletin, Malandi McCarthy reflects on failed voice referendum, outlines path forward for Indigenous affairs. A sheriff says a third assassination attempt against Donald Trump has been thwarted. And a new plan announced to prepare Australia for the expected arrival of a deadly variant of bird flu. Indigenous Affairs Minister Malandiri McCarthy says the federal government is working on ways to progress Indigenous affairs 1 year after the failed voice referendum result. The majority of Indigenous communities voted in favour of the proposal, but the ACT was the only jurisdiction with a majority yes vote, with more than 60% of residents voting in favour. Speaking to NITV News and SBS, Ms. McCarthy says it has been a difficult anniversary to reflect on. She adds the government is still working on ways to move forward, and that includes hearing views on a Makarrata Commission for Truth-Telling and Treaty.
When we saw the weaponisation of Indigenous issues throughout the referendum, it was an incredibly difficult and painful time, that kind of lowering of the debate on a matter that was so important. Tomorrow will be the first committee hearing of the Truth and Justice Bill by the Senate that will travel across the country and enable Australians to give their voice to what the next steps should be.
1 year on from the failed referendum outcome for Indigenous constitutional recognition, campaigners say there has been a setback in progress for Indigenous affairs. Yes campaigner Thomas Mayo says it has been disappointing to see no proponents try to cancel all things First Nations. He says it's time to rebuild hope and trust.
And we've seen that through their efforts to wind back welcomes to country and acknowledgements of country. There's been a resistance against those. There's been continuing disinformation about almost anything that's positive in Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander affairs. It's urgent that we rebuild empathy and hope to achieve rights for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people in this country and to close the gap, and that's the only way that we're going to get there.
A man with a shotgun, a loaded handgun, ammunition and several fake passports has been arrested in what a sheriff says was likely a third assassination attempt of Donald Trump. The former president had yet to arrive at a rally in California when a 49-year-old Las Vegas resident attempted to gain entry by claiming to be a journalist. The suspicion of law enforcement officers was raised when they noticed the fake number plate on his vehicle. A search revealed the illegal possession of the multiple firearms. Riverside County Chief Sheriff Chad Bianco says law enforcement officers deserve praise for how they handled the incident. He says he believed a third assassination attempt of Donald Trump was thwarted, but he refused to speculate about the suspect's motives or frame of mind, saying that would be a matter for the FBI to investigate.
I couldn't care less what political party he belongs to. I honestly think that's the stupidest thing in the world, that we have to label something and we're labeling this as politics. From my perspective in law enforcement, that group, if in fact it turns out that he is part of the sovereign citizens group, they are certainly considered a far right group. So I think it's fringe one way or the other. I couldn't care less. It's people trying to do harm, and thank God we prevented it.
The man arrested has been identified as Vem Miller. He has been released on bail and is due to appear in court on January 2. The King of Bhutan, Jigme Khaesan Migyel Wangchuck, has met with Prime Minister Anthony Albanese during his maiden 8-day visit to Australia. Bhutan's embassy says the king will conduct community events in Sydney, Canberra and Perth. While many Bhutanese community members will enjoy an audience with the monarch, Lutsampa refugees say they have been denied such access. They say they have sought an audience with the king to demand the release of family members incarcerated in Bhutanese prisons as political prisoners. The federal government has announced $95 million to fund a series of measures to prepare for bird flu. While Australia is the only continent free of the H5N1 variant of avian influenza, farmers have been warned to prepare for its arrival. Environment Minister Tanya Plibersek says while no cases of H5N1 have been detected in Australia yet, it's important to be prepared for its impact if it does arrive.
It is very likely that this strain will eventually reach Australia. Spring is the most likely time for it to hit because of those migratory bird species that will come in from countries where this strain is prevalent. We are doing our very best to make sure that we don't see mortality that would send threatened species extinct in the wild. We're trying to prevent that.
As part of the plan, $22.1 million is being set aside for vaccine development for human protection against bird flu. Chief Medical Officer Professor Paul Kelly says vaccines are also being prepared as part of the precautions.
I'd say just very clearly that there's a extremely low risk of human disease from this particular organism right now in Australia. It's really when, not if, that this arrives. And we've seen in other parts of the world, whilst there has been rather mild human disease so far, this virus is changing very quickly.
Australians are being urged to check their tech devices to ensure they're ready when the 3G service is switched off in the next fortnight to increase support for 4G and 5G. The switchover is expected to boost the data capacity, speed and capability for Australia's mobile networks, but older devices could be rendered non-operational by the change, including an inability to dial emergency services on 000. Any connected tech product that relies on 3G, including medical devices, could also be impacted. Communications Minister Michelle Rowland urged people not to wait the last moment to check their tech devices.
The 3G switchover is fast approaching. It's important because it's going to enable better 4G and 5G mobile technology, and that's going to mean better capacity and speed of our networks. But in the lead up to the switchover on the 28th of October, I urge all Australians to check your tech, including connected devices like medical alarms and smartwatches that might rely on 3G.
A new study has found infant and toddler food found in supermarkets falls short of nutrient requirements set out by the World Health Organization. The Monash University data suggests 23% of food products met all nutrient requirements, while 43% exceeded recommended limits for sugar. In 2023, commercial baby food sales in Australia, including prepared baby food, generated over $370 million in revenue. Lead researcher and dietitian Dr. Alexandra Chung says government action needs to be taken on the issue.
We're really pleased that the government has shown interest in improving commercial foods for babies and toddlers. The government has recently consulted on this topic, so experts have been able to provide their recommendations. And what we would like to see is comprehensive regulation that's tighter around what can go into these foods, as well as the way they're labelled and promoted to parents and families.
Israel's military says four soldiers were killed in a Hezbollah drone attack that hit central Israel, injuring more than 60 people. With Israel's advanced air defense systems, it's rare for so many people to be hurt by drones or missiles. Israeli media reported that two drones were launched from Lebanon, and the military says one was intercepted. The Lebanon-based Hezbollah militant group claimed responsibility, saying it targeted a military camp. Hezbollah says the strike was retaliation for two Israeli strikes in Beirut on Thursday that killed 22 people. Paramedic Rafi Sheva says many of those injured need to be taken to hospital immediately.
It was a difficult scene. The impact of the drone strike caused injuries due to the blast and shrapnel. Serious injuries. Those injured needed life-saving treatment and were quickly evacuated to the hospitals.
And to sport in tennis, Novak Djokovic has been denied his 100th title, falling in straight sets to Jannik Sinner at the Shanghai Masters. This season has been the Sinner's most successful on tour, with 7 trophies so far this year, including 2 Grand Slams, 3 ATP Masters 1000 titles, and wins in Rotterdam and Halle. 24 times Grand Slam champion Djokovic had been aiming to become one of 3 players in history to claim 100 titles, alongside Jimmy Connors and Roger Federer. The victory confirms Sinner's position at the top of the ATP rankings for the remainder of the 2024 season. The 23-year-old is still dealing with the possibility of a doping ban to be applied. This after the World Anti-Doping Agency launched an appeal against a ruling clearing him of wrongdoing following 2 positive drug tests. He's still able to play while the case is ongoing. He says he's doing his best to stay focused.
Physically, I'm ready to play for a longer amount of time at the highest level possible. Also mentally, I'm ready to accept every tough situation on the court, and which I think that's the biggest step I made forward. And, you know, just trying to stay as calm as possible and even to keep working hard.
And having a look at the weather around the country, Broome, sunny day and a top of 33, Perth, a shower or 2, 23 degrees, Adelaide, partly cloudy, 27, Melbourne, a shower or 2, 20, Hobart, possible shower, 23, Albury, Wodonga, mostly cloudy, 24, Canberra, showers with a possible storm and a top of 23, Wollongong, showers increasing, 23, Sydney, similar conditions and 25 degrees, Newcastle, showers and 24, Brisbane, partly cloudy and 25 degrees, Townsville, mostly cloudy, 26, Cairns, a shower or 2, 31, Alice Springs, sunny, 34 degrees, Darwin, a shower or 2 and 33 degrees, and Torres Strait Islands, a sunny day ahead and a top of 31 degrees. And that is NITV Radio News.
NITV Radio, Monday, Wednesday, Friday at 1 p.m. or anytime online.
And that was Take Me Home by Proud Gamilaroi woman Lorraine Ryan. I'm Bertrand Tungandame, and you're listening to ITV Radio, coming to you from Nam on the Kulin Nation this Monday afternoon. Well, today is Monday, the 14th of October, exactly 1 year after the failed referendum on Indigenous voice to Parliament. Our program today will reflect on the referendum, featuring exclusive stories brought to us by SBS Examines Deputy Editor Rachel Knowles. We have a yarn with Connor Bowden, a teacher who, instead of being able to teach and pass on knowledge, found himself fighting misinformation through social media. Also, Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Social Justice Commissioner Katie Case reflects on where she was when the vote was called, also reflects on the results and the severe emotional impact on communities who had to grapple with feelings of rejections. First, an interview with University of New South Wales Professor Gabrielle Appleby, reflecting on her involvement in the process leading up to the referendum. Professor Gabrielle Appleby was involved in the regional dialogues and constitutional convention that developed the voice proposal. She explained to Rachel Knowles that it would have been a representative, the voice would have been a representative body for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people to advise Parliament and government on laws, policies affecting them. The voice was proposed to be constitutionally enshrined to provide recognition and stability, as previous advisory bodies had been abolished at the government's whim. As a constitutional law expert, Professor Appleby was involved in fact-checking during the referendum campaign. She noted it was concerning that even after fact-checks were published, politicians and campaigners would often repeat the same misleading claims.
What is a voice to Parliament and how would that operate? Could you tell me from your expertise what that actually would have looked like?
The referendum was about inserting a provision in the Constitution that would establish a body that would fulfil this role of being a voice for First Nations people to both Parliament and to the government. Now, having been involved with the regional dialogues and the constitutional convention, which this idea came out of, there was quite a lot of clarity as to what was being asked for. Right? There was being asked for a representative body that represented Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people across Australia, at the grassroots, at the local level, but was a national body. It would have a role not in making laws, not in delivering programs and policies, speaking to government, speaking to Parliament on behalf of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people, so as to improve policies, so as to improve laws, so as to improve the way that funding was delivered into communities. And that was the core of what was being asked for, a representative body that would represent views of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people to government and Parliament. It was to be constitutionally enshrined. That had a couple of roles. The first was because that would perform an act of recognition, recognising the place of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people in our democracy and the history of their connection to country, but also because constitutional enshrinement would provide stability and certainty to this body, because the experience of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people had been that they had had bodies in the past, but they had been given and taken away by Parliament or government at a whim, and they needed stability and certainty to operate.
I guess in terms of the lead up to the referendum, so you were involved in fact checking, and particularly, I would love to pick your brain right now about the fact that the AEC did have to put out kind of a public education campaign about how to vote in this referendum. Can you tell me from your experience being involved in these processes, misinformation in terms of vote, in terms of yes or no aside, but the misinformation around going into the voting booth and what that actually looked like for people, and the fact that a public education campaign had to be pushed out to explain the process to people. What are your thoughts on that?
You know, it's very rare for Australia to engage in a constitutional referendum process, right? We don't do constitutional change very often, and the last two attempts we've made at it, this referendum and the 1999 referendum, have not been successful. So constitutional change is hard and we don't do it very often. It's not the same as an election. And so I think the part of the education campaign in relation to how to vote in the referendum was because it is something for most electors they hadn't done.
I wasn't able to vote in the 1999 referendum. It was my first referendum that I was voting in, and for many Australians that would have been the same. So just understanding, well, what happens, what's different from a general election, what are we doing here with a referendum?
Can you tell me a little bit about how you became involved and kind of the learnings that you had during that process of fact-checking in the lead-up?
I had written quite a lot about the proposal, having been involved in the regional dialogues and understanding what was being sought by Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people coming out of that process, but also with my expertise as a constitutional lawyer and with a particular expertise in government and parliamentary processes. So I had written quite a lot about the proposed First Nations voice, the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander voice. And then when the referendum campaign started, there was a great need by news sources, and I think that's a really admirable thing that they did, to put out fact checks on statements that were being made, whether that was by politicians or by campaigners or prominent campaigners, to get to the bottom of some of the brash statements that were being made in the course of the campaign, as well as to provide kind of like explainers, kind of like what we've spoken about. What is the voice? Why does it need to be constitutionally enshrined? So I was involved across a vast number of news outlets in relation to fact checks, which was great. That, I think, was a positive experience. It was a bit concerning being one of the many experts involved, that you might do a fact check in relation to a statement that was made about perhaps, for example, the proposed amendment would put race and differentiation into the constitution. It would be a divisive amendment. And then, of course, in the fact check would say, well, actually, no, our constitution already has a provision about race and it's used against Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people. It can be used in a negative way. So there already is this division, and this amendment is actually trying to ameliorate some of that division and give Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people a positive place in the constitution. So that's an example. And yet we do a fact check about a statement like this, and one of the difficult parts of the referendum campaign is that fact check would go out into the world, it might be read, but then you'd come full circle. And the next week, a politician or a campaigner might say the same thing, and the fact check would start from scratch again. And I really think that we need to get better in these kinds of campaigns, so that those fact checks then come around and influence the way the media is reporting statements by politicians and campaigners. So it's not like you're starting from ground zero again. The media should already know. Now, that's already been fact-checked. You can't just say it again and get front-page reporting. That needs to go through the filter of what the fact-checks have already said. I think we need to be much more proactive as we see campaigns using this misinformation, disinformation, decontextualised information. I think we're only going to see more of it, and I think we need to get smarter about how we use those kinds of fact-checks.
And that was Professor Gabrielle Appleby talking to SBS Examine's Rachel Knowles. We must now go to a break, but stay with us. When we come back, we continue our reflections on the failed voice referendum with Connor Boyden, a teacher who found himself actually fighting misinformation instead of doing his regular work as a teacher and also a community organizer. For this, stay tuned.
NITV Radio, on radio, online and mobile.
And that was Eternity by Mikaisha. This song actually speaks to the lineage of strong, fierce, brilliant Pacific Islander women Mikaisha was raised by.
Join the conversation on radio, online and mobile. You're with NITV Radio.
Now, Kuna Bowden is a traditional owner and teacher who played a significant role in advocating for the Indigenous voice to Parliament. His family, hailing from northeast Arnhem Land, helped spearhead the Uluru Statement and push for constitutional constitutionally enshrined voice. Drawing from personal experiences and the historical impact of government policies on remote communities, Barden has actively worked to inform the public. He told SBS Examine's Rachel Knowles how, leading up to the voice referendum, he campaigned against misinformation, addressing false claims spread by lobbyist groups like Advance Australia.
My name's Connor Bowden. I'm a Tagalaga and Gumatj man. I am from the NT, born and bred. I'm an educator, and I also create educational videos on social media platforms to help inform people about Indigenous politics and other things happening in the Northern Territory and around the state.
In terms of the Uluru Statement and the Voice to Parliament, tell me about your involvement from, I suppose, the early stages.
The community where I'm from, of Northeast Arnhem Land, and my family were actually people who led the charge in creating the Uluru Statement, first of all, as well as really championing a voice to Parliament, as well as being constitutionally enshrined in the Australian Constitution. And this is, you know, people from very remote areas of Australia, Nhulunbuy, Northeast Arnhem Land, all around that region. Everyone really was for this and really pushed for it for many, many years before we even got, even before we had the Uluru Statement or anything like that. There was, you know, many occurrences such as like the Yirrkala Bark petitions, the Barunga petitions and stuff like that, all of Yolngu people coming together to ask for more help from the government and to ask to be recognised in the constitution. So from then onwards, really, I was kind of at some point involved with the Uluru Statement, although we ended up saying the voice, but that whole referendum period. And, you know, seeing especially the conception of the Uluru Statement, you know, from its beginning, my family, my mum in particular, was very involved in it. And, you know, hearing all the stories from her really, like, helped me to get a grasp of it before, you know, the general public had even had an idea of it. It had never been something evil, even from its conception, you know, even from before it. No one there wanted anything more than just to say it or a seat at the table to be able to help their own communities. There was no one pulling for more money or we want everything here and we want to make the rules and everything. It was more about, we need a say, especially families from the bush. So people from the bush, which is, you know, my family's from very remote areas of Australia and they have no say in what happens to their community. It is often just the government makes the rules, they come in and they do what they want and then they leave the people and they have to deal with the ramifications afterwards. So this happened in things like the Dupuma Barker School, or the Dupuma School back then, when the NT government decided to completely defund learning in two languages or in dual languages. Pretty much as soon as that decision was made, the school was, you know, pulled the rug out from underneath of it, and they had to find another way to teach all the kids that were there. And they went to a predominantly English-based school, and they struggled, and the teachers struggled with them, and so on and so forth. So my whole idea of getting involved with the referendum and stuff for that was to be able to project my voice, because I know about the historical implications of policy and stuff like that that happens to remote people. So I wanted to be able to explain to people why it's important that people from remote areas can actually have a voice. And because we see all the statistics all the time, everyone's seen the statistics, no one can sit here and go, no, I don't know about the closing the gap and how we're still falling behind. Like, it's reported on every kind of week, I feel, and we don't do anything to change it. So my motivations to get involved were predominantly to help remote communities.
And in terms of, I think, knowing from its conception and then, you know, seeing the lead up to the referendum, when the campaign started to ramp up, what were the pieces of misinformation that, I suppose, you listened to and you just thought, I can't believe that that's something that people are saying about this? Like, that does not make sense to me.
Nearly everything that Advance Australia posted on their social media. Advance Australia is a lobbyist group that was going around when, even before land rights, but when Native Title came in, at Advance Australia's core kind of conglomerate were people that are trying to take down Native Title back then. So if you don't know this stuff unless you've done your research, it's no good stuff. But a lot of the stuff they posted, they were paying people a lot of money to say things. They were finding the outliers and getting them to, you know, say what they thought because, you know, they had, you know, a black face or they were, you know, an Aboriginal person. And they were feeding these people lies too. In terms of specific stuff, we sit on this rhetoric that Aboriginal people want to take your backyard or they want to tax your job more or they want to take away your income or something like that when it's not true. Like, all these people out in community, like, they just want to be able to live their life happily and they want to be able to live connected with their culture without having to give up a part of themselves to actually be a part of general society, which isn't a unrealistic point to have, but there was so many lies that were just spilled. The 162-page real Uluru statement. Like, what are you talking about? And then there was another one. I think it was like the UN's going to take over Australia if you vote yes to this. Like, it is complete nonsense that was happening. And, you know, for me being involved in the Uluru statement, eventually I got involved with the Uluru Hands on the Heart, stuff like that. I was able to go and visit and do a couple like workshops with them that allowed me to actually kind of understand everything a bit more and how to kind of create and make social media content. That's where I kind of started doing all that stuff, and it was a great thing for me to be able to learn and get some skills to be able to do that. We were trying to just educate people. All of my resources I made throughout the referendum was just purely educational. Like, I'm a teacher now. I've been studying to be a teacher for far longer than I want to actually admit. But I'd been, you know, doing that for ages, learning how to teach and inform people. And instead of me just being able to teach and pass some knowledge on to other people, it was bordered with me having to undo all these lies that people have been told through large accounts like Advance Australia, through news corporations. So instead of me going, this is how the referendum's going to help my community, or this is how somewhere in the past we see policy coming through and without being informed by the community and undoing everything, just like Dupama College out in Nhulunbuy, I was having to explain to people why the UN isn't actually going to take the country over, or why being in a constitution or having rights in a constitution doesn't mean you had ceded your sovereignty by doing that, by getting rights in a constitution.
I wanted to ask you as well, because I know that when all of this was happening, there was this like kind of horrible rhetoric that it was like, you know, the elites that were pushing this and da 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 da. Something that I wanted to ask you was, you know, the content that you put out that I enjoyed was just the fact that, like, for you to be able to kind of bring it back to yourself, to bring it back to your home, to make content from home with your dogs, like, yeah, it's a kind of, that made it really visible that it's not an elite thing. And I think, was that something that you were conscious of when you were making content?
I'm tertiary educated. I'm able to go and sit in the classroom or sit in a lecture theatre or read stuff online and be able to understand it, all the isms and stuff like that and the ologies of stuff, whatever it is, you know, like, I can get it. While I don't always take it super seriously, like, I can understand it, which is a luxury to have, you know, to be able to understand and do this stuff. Like, I've worked hard to get here, or I've worked over a very long time to get here, but I've got family that can't understand it, you know, that don't get it. I've got a close family that, you know, are very smart and very switched on, but are tradies or are, you know, are working in service industries or something like that, that don't understand this stuff. And it goes completely over everyone's head. Like, you know, scholarly people and, you know, tertiary educated or highly educated people, even, you know, people who have the Year 12 certificate can understand some of this stuff too. You know, like, I'm not trying to discriminate or say that people aren't smart or anything, but it did get down to, like, a whole lot of just chucking large words out there and chucking big names and this is colonialism and neoliberalism and, you know, the government's turning into a, you know, whatever. And I sat there and I said, look, it all makes sense to me, but no one else is going to be able to get this. And we can keep talking about it and keep throwing this stuff out there, but no one's going to get it and they're going to ignore it. So how can I explain this in a way that is dumbed down? It's just made in a way that is accessible to people. And in education, you learn about when you run a lesson, you do scaffolding, you have a hook, and you have find a way to you know, to make it digestible for people. In creating the videos, I found, you know, a hook, which is my dogs or the things that we did, like something to make it fun and engaging, you know, just to get people to actually watch it, especially on social media. Social media is an attention economy. You need people to want to stay for more than 0.17 seconds or 0.7 seconds, I think, 0.7 before they swipe away. So you need to get them there and you need to get them with something. And with the no side, they had really nasty ways of doing it, divisive ways of doing it, whereas mine, I, you know, I kind of use my dogs or I use nature and I got the leaves and showed it with leaves and stuff like that. And finding ways to make it digestible was huge.
We must now step aside for a break. When we come back, we continue our coverage of reflections on the failed Indigenous Voice to Parliament referendum, thanks to stories brought to us by SBS Examine's Rachel Knowles.
Join the conversation on radio, online and mobile. You're with NITV Radio.
Welcome back. Now in a conversation with SBS Examine's Rachel Knowles, Katie Case, the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Social Justice Commissioner, reflects on the failed Indigenous Voice to Parliament referendum with deep disappointment. Despite this, Case emphasizes the importance of continuing to push for truth, treaty, and tangible outcomes to improve the lives of First Nations people while affirming their inherent belonging.
Rachel, thanks for having me on SBS Examines. I think this is a really important conversation to be having 12 months since the on the anniversary of the 2023 voice referendum. As we know, that discussion and that conversation didn't just come up in October 2023. It's been a long journey of almost 20 years of focused discussion and debate around constitutional recognition and the reform of the Constitution to give voice to First Nations Australians. But it didn't just start there either. It started 200 years ago when First Peoples called for treaty and called for recognition in the Constitution, called for our right to vote, stood for the rights of First Nations people. This conversation's been going on for a very, very long time. It culminated in the referendum on the 14th of October. My view going into that was I had a great sense of optimism from our country, that our people in Australia had moved beyond this negative stereotypes of First Nations people. They were hungry for a relationship that was based on unity and reconciliation. Obviously, we didn't get there. The misinformation and disinformation that was spread throughout the campaign caused significant damage to the efforts of both First Nations people and Indigenous Australians who lobbied and advocated for this outcome. And I think it was a very sad day in Australia's history when that referendum was defeated.
Where were you on that day? And I guess how were you feeling when you did hear the news about the referendum's failure?
Well, on the 14th of October, I was sitting in my bedroom, as I do at every election, watching the election coverage or the referendum coverage. I was watching the vote on TV. I was sitting there with absolute optimism that Australians would come to the table on this, and that, you know, we had come to a point where Australians were going to finally give Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people the place that they deserve in this country as First Peoples of this land. So on the 14th of October, I went into that day with a really high level of optimism that we were going to do this, that we were going to get this right, that history was about to be made. You know, half an hour in, I called Mick Gooder, who was in Perth at the time. And so the voting hadn't actually opened in Perth when I rang him to talk to him about where the commentary was going on TV. Anyway, 30% of the vote had been counted, and I'm still sitting there with great optimism that we were going to get this across the line. And then they started calling locations and saying that the vote had been defeated in those areas. I still had Mick on the phone at this point, and Mick said to me, "It's gone." I'm even emotional just thinking about that now, you know, like the vote was gone half an hour into it. And I said to Mick, "It's only 30% of the vote counted. We've still got a long way to go." He said, "Katie, it's done." And so I was sort of left a little bit in shock about where do we go from here? How do we come to terms with this result? 2 days after that, we were in Queensland. We were actually working really hard, and we had made significant contributions to the conversation in Queensland about the importance of the referendum and its connection with Truth and Treaty, the work that we were working on, Mick and I were working on at that point. You know, 2 days after the vote, the opposition leader here in Queensland came out and announced that if they were to win government in the election that's coming on the 26th of October here in Queensland, they would withdraw the Parts Treaty Act. So the referendum has had diabolical consequences for First Nations policy in this country and the advancement of those other key critical elements and pillars of the Uluru Statement that need to be advanced in order to change the dial for First Nations Australians. And so 2 days after we had that news that the opposition leader was going to withdraw, Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people across the country had determined that they needed a week to come to terms with what that result meant for us. So we went into a week of silence. But in Queensland, we couldn't take that opportunity because we came under automatic fire. We had the Queensland Police Union president come out on the front page of the state paper saying that the treaty process in Queensland would give a free license for rapists, murderers and domestic violence abusers. So the racism was automatic. I had my son call me 2 days after the referendum vote when he went to work on the Monday morning. And he said to me, "Mum, I can't do this. How do I walk out on the street when these people don't want me here?" So the impact of this has been absolutely extreme on our people, on our people's hearts, on our people's minds and on our people's souls. You know, we've got a long way now to come back from that and to repair the damage that's been done to that relationship.
Where do you sit now? What happens now? You know, how you don't know the people around you who did vote no and who did vote yes and who is a friend and who isn't, kind of thing. The impact of the referendum on the strength of the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander community, but the feeling of belonging, particularly when we're talking about social cohesion and everybody's place within the country, and Australia being, you know, one of the most multicultural communities in, like, globally, but the way that the referendum has, I suppose, severed that feeling of belonging and place for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people even more so than already existed. Can you talk to me about that and kind of the damage that a failed referendum has done in terms of a sense of belonging, and I guess the way forward, or how that heals?
The thing that confuses me in this whole conversation is that a process that was promoted as being inclusive, including by the opposition, turned into being so divisive and exclusive of First Nations people in this country, the first peoples of this country, 65,000 years of cultural heritage and connection, the oldest living cultures in the world. Yes, in the days after, in the months after, and for some still to this day, we are questioning our sense of belonging in this country. That is our cultural heritage. Our belonging is undeniable. So Australians who voted no can argue all they like that Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people don't have the right to be recognised as the first peoples of this land. They can argue all they like that we shouldn't be giving welcome to country. But those laws have been embedded in this place for 65,000 years. So Aboriginal people and Torres Strait Islander people should never question their belonging, because we know where we come from. We know our place. Yes, it's been severed and damaged by the impact of colonisation on our peoples, and some people are still trying to find their connection. But we know we as Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people are from this place. This is our home. When people say, "Go back to where you come from," where is that? This is here. So we shouldn't be questioning our belonging. And for us, sovereignty and self-determination is a doing thing. We act as sovereigns. We act as First Nations. We act with pride in our culture and identity. We don't have to take the questioning from anybody else around that, because that is our birthright. So that's the first point of start here, the first starting point here, that we should not be questioning our own belonging in this place. Yes, we feel rejection. Yes, we feel hurt by people who have come to this place and are questioning our sense of belonging here, but we should never question that ourselves. The next step for me is to continue to stay true to Uluru and the three pillars of the Uluru Statement from the Heart, voice, treaty and truth. I think the other thing to say, Rachel, is that the referendum outcome, and this has been something that I've been watching on social media and in the media more broadly, the referendum outcome did not deny Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people their human rights. It did not deny our pre-existence here before colonisation. Terra Nullius didn't get turned over because of the referendum debate or the referendum outcome. That still is the same doctrine, and it was overturned by the High Court in Mabo. So our position here is unquestioned. We need to stay true to those three pillars. The voice referendum only confirmed that there is to be no voice model incorporated in the Constitution, and that we did not have recognition in Australia's Constitution. That was all that the referendum did. It had no consequence and no impact on our conversation around the need for the establishment of voice mechanisms more broadly to facilitate First Nations people's decision-making and input into decisions that affect us. And it had no consequence or impact on the negotiations, the dialogues, the conversations that are happening around the country that go to agreement making, treaty and truth. So we need to stay true to those things. The other thing that is absolutely critical and that formed a key point of the debate in the opposition's approach to this conversation was that we need to focus on practical and tangible outcomes that create better lives for First Nations people. Have no disagreement on that whatsoever. And we've seen bipartisan support from both sides of politics to the Closing the Gap campaign. We need to maintain that momentum, because improving those targets and improving the outcomes under each of those areas of focus is critical for the practical outcomes that they talk to in bettering the lives of First Nations people. But in saying that, those targets are where they are because of the impact of colonisation. Those targets are where they are because of the breach of human rights. Every single one of those targets is a human rights area that needs to be improved because of the breach of those rights for First Nations people. And that is also why the Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People is critical to shaping and forming and informing the approach to Indigenous policy going forward.
NITV Radio, on radio, online and mobile.
And that's all from us on NITV Radio today. A big thank you to SBS Examines, Rachel Knowles, who brought to us these very powerful reflections on the failed referendum on voice to parliament. I'm Bertrand Tungandame, thanking you for your company this Monday afternoon. Till next time, bye for now. Leaving you with the Becker Boy in Medellin. Breaking and popping on my boys, pop locking. Gotta steal it.